Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast, presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and with me, as always, is Coach Chad Timmerman.
Hello.
And our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And this is where you get your chance to ask your coaching questions, whether they're cycling or triathlon related, and or they don't even have to be coaching related. Whatever questions you have about training, cycling, triathlon, whatever they may be, we'll do our best to answer them, and you can submit those to us at trainerroad.com/podcast. There's a form on there where you can fill out your questions. You can see other questions we've answered, listen to the latest episode, check everything out there. You can also find this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever other podcasting app you use, and you can also leave us reviews on there. Give us 5 stars. We love that. Or however many stars you feel is merited, but we feel like we deserve 5, right?
It's less than 5. Guys. You can email Jonathan at trainerroad.com. Tell him why.
You gave out my email.
it's not hard. Right.
That's true. It's pretty straightforward. All right. So let's kick things off actually this week with Ray's question. It's from Twitter. He used the Ask Trainer Road hashtag, and that's another way you can ask us questions on Twitter or Instagram. Just hashtag Ask Trainer Road, and we can see it there. And that keeps it to 140 characters, which, surprisingly enough, guys, you can get across quite a lot in 140 characters. So Ray's question, he says, why isn't speed considered when talking about power and FTP? I can hold 300 watts all day at 10 miles an hour, but at race speed, only 158 watts.
So that's a little crazy difference in the wattage. I'd be curious to see what power meter, but in general, speed is the output of, like, is the result of your power. So this goes back to, like, high school physics or college physics, wherever you took it. You put in, so, like, the, if you have a formula, you put in your power, and then power has to overcome certain forces while you're riding. One is rolling resistance. Another is the drag of air. And the third is, if you're going uphill, is gravity. So if you're going downhill, you know, you get an increased force as gravity is pulling you downhill, and if you're going uphill, you have to overcome gravity. So in general, the speed and even your what gearing you have, a lot of people get that confused, as they think what gear they're in means that they're putting out more watts. And that, I mean, it does if all the other things are the same. So if you're on the same road, you have the same amount of drag, and you know, it's the same incline or pitch, then a bigger gear will mean you're putting out more power. But it doesn't necessarily, just because you're riding the big gear, mean you're putting out more power than somebody in a small gear that's on a climb. This also question probably leads back to something we've talked about a little bit before, is what kind of rider you're at. And a lot of riders feel that they have the ability to put more power out on a climb. Part of that, I think it's a little bit mentally easier on a climb too, because you get like constant feedback. And if you let up at all, you totally feel it instantly. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I just think it's not a reliable metric. So power measures the work you're doing. Heart rate measures basically how hard your body's working. Speed can fluctuate too wildly. I mean, you can do the same road, same time of day, but you know, maybe you're dealing with a 20-mile-an-hour headwind, and speed's going to fall. Everything else is going to stay the same. So it's just there are too many things, too many variables that affect speed. And then when it comes to indoor training, especially if you're on an ergometer, it becomes basically meaningless, and it really boils down to gearing. I think a lot of people get confused because they, especially the guys who are training on ergo trainers, they put it in a big gear and they see these high miles per hour, and then they put it in a small gear and they see low miles per hour, but all the while the watts stay consistently the same. So, I mean, that just illustrates the point that especially on ergo trainers, speed is pretty much irrelevant indoors.
Yeah, I think that. So keep in mind, if you were to ride 100 miles on a flat course or 100 miles on a hilly course, your average speed is probably going to be very different if you're climbing a lot of that time. And that doesn't, so speed doesn't represent that, like what Chad said. The important thing is that really, if you aren't on an electronic trainer, so you aren't on a smart trainer inside, your gearing, it still doesn't necessarily reflect the power. It's really how hard, power is simply a function of force and speed. And when we talk about speed, we're not talking about how fast you're moving down the road necessarily, but how quickly you're either turning your pedals or how quickly, you know, you're turning at the hub, anything like that. So that's what a power meter takes into account to calculate power, because that way it's a much more objective way to measure your work. It's not just pressing super hard on the pedals, you know, because if that was the case, shifting up and hardly moving forward, but pressing really hard on the pedals in a really hard gear would mean a lot of power. And contrary to popular belief, that is not a lot of power. A lot of power is your ability to press hard and move those pedals over so that you can move forward. So yeah, that's how it works.
So one part of Ray's question is, he says, I can hold 300 watts all day at 10 miles per hour, but at race speed, only 158. So right there, Ray, if you could respond to us with how you got that data, because to me that I have alarm bells going off, like that's probably not right. If you can hold 300 all day and then in a race 158, half the power, something's off right there.
I mean, not using a power meter inside or outside. He's using, I don't know, something like
clipping speed sensor or something.
Yeah, maybe I was thinking maybe Strava power. You know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you're doing.
Which Strava power is an estimate. Keep in mind, if you don't have your power meter there, you know it's an estimate. So it's not necessarily something. It's not measuring while you're riding. It's just an estimate after the fact. So let's move on to John's question. He says, looking at some of the other users' workouts on specific rides, and this is with Trainer Road, he's saying, I was wondering why I have such a poor baseline on my power data. It looks like my power varies a lot, up or down at least 10 to 15 watts. That isn't really a lot, though, right, guys? 10 to 15 mm-hmm. watts? It's pretty normal. No,
yeah.
Yeah. And that's even on the trainer. So, I mean, outside, you're going to see greater variances. But on the trainer in a controlled environment, that's not out of the norm. So he says, I have my app set to power match in erg mode on a Wahoo kicker. So that just means that essentially he's got his power meter paired and his smart trainer paired. And then we're using the power data, not from the smart trainer, but we're using it from his power meter. He says, my cadence stays pretty much in the mid 90s. I don't feel any change, but reviewing the data afterwards, I see a really static or he says erratic baseline. I have tried the smoothing and that did not seem to help it. But I did see an obvious lag in the readings when doing intense intervals with no spin up. He says he's riding a Fuji Norcom straight using a Wahoo kicker and Vector pedals. Some alarm bells go off when I hear that. And then he says, my Vector data on my Garmin 920 XT is not recording this drastic of a change in the power data. Any help would be appreciated. He goes through in his stats. We can touch on those later. But he says, I'm an avid listener. Look forward to the podcast every week or sooner. 5 stars for me for sure on iTunes. Great job. Thanks. Thanks, John.
Go ahead. Thanks, John.
John, let me just jump in. I'll just give my 2 cents and then let you guys elaborate on the tech behind it. But I am an avid kicker user, and I have at the start of the year introduced Power Match. So I went from, I think, John, what you're looking at are graphs where people are riding a kicker in erg mode. And it smooth or not, it puts out, the kicker smooths itself, and I'll let them talk about that. But I have really pretty graphs up until about the turn of the year where I started working, or I started using Power Match, and now I'm seeing exactly what you're seeing. They're a little more erratic. 10 to 15 watt fluctuations are commonplace, but I'm getting the same workout. We're just seeing a different graphic representation of it. So nothing to worry about is what I'm telling you.
Yeah, so for those who don't know Power Match, what that does is if you have a Wahoo kicker and a power meter, people have seen that there'll maybe be a 20-watt difference between those two. And Power Match is we'll take, as you're riding, we'll keep sampling or actually taking averages with, I don't need to get into the algorithm, but we'll take pretty much data from your power meter and adjust the kicker so that your kicker's targets and your, so that pretty much the two match. So two things here. One, the Wahoo kicker. It measures the power at the flywheel, and the Wahoo kicker is incredibly smooth data, like artificially smooth. It's not a representation of what you're actually, well, it is a representation, but it's not as detailed of a representation of what you're putting out. So if you look on Trainer Road, you'll see people with the Wahoo kicker, and it's like the whole time they're within 2 watts of target, and it never changes. And if that's just, it's how it puts it out, and some people feel really good that seeing it, but I don't want to burst your bubble. It's not really what's happening. And now that you
and
have
you probably
the Vector,
know that too, John. I mean, you've ridden outside. If you have Vectors and you've seen your power data outside, and you know it's not that smooth, so you're probably aware of that. Continue.
You might think though with a kicker because it's changing the power and it's like kind of mm-hmm. being a transmission for you to keep you at your correct power that will fix it, but. So now you've entered into this power meter, a second measure, the vectors of measuring your power. And plus the vectors are on your pedals. So it's measuring like really close to the source, like pretty much as close as you can get unless it's inside the shoe. And that data is, as you saw, more erratic. And now it's funny is that if you turned off your vectors, your data would be perfectly smooth. And if you had it on, it'd be erratic. Not erratic, but it's just kind of more jaggedy. And that's just the way you are. You're not a machine. That's reality. It's still, you're still going to get a great workout. It's still the same on the kicker. Like nothing changes but the display. And when you do smoothing with Trainer Road, we only just smooth your power. We don't smooth the graph. We might change that just because of questions like this. People, they want smooth, pretty graphs, but it's not reality. So it's it's kind of like, should we let them alter reality to feel better, or should we just force reality on them? And the last one with your Garmin 920 is two things. I bet you you're either paired to your kicker because you can pair to your kicker and you're running off that power, or you have some smoothing on your Garmin display. And then also the last one is, if you really still think that it's not recording the drastic changes, you can download your Garmin file and download the Trainer Road file and then upload them both to something like Strava that would smooth the data. And then you should be able to see them, and they'll be pretty much one for one. I'm highly confident that, you know, we're recording the data correctly. What we do is we take 1 second samples, and that's what the Garmin 920 does if you have it set to 1 second sampling. So that's the reason.
Let's move on to Chris's question. He says, thank you guys for an amazing podcast. I gained valuable information and tips with each episode. I have a question about VO2 max intervals. I know that once you drop under a certain power level, 110 to 120%, for example, during a VO2 max interval, it is not beneficial and becomes, and he says in quotes here, another type of workout. I've seen this statement many places, but I haven't seen any information elaborating what physiologically is changing when a VO2 interval is done under that limit. Can you elaborate on what's happening, why it's detrimental to perform a VO2 interval, which that's, we'll debunk some things here, but perform a VO2 interval below that point, and if I'm training outside without power, how to determine when I've dropped below that beneficial threshold? Thank you.
Chris, glad you brought this up. I'm sorry to hear that this has been misconstrued. I don't want to give the impression that intervals become detrimental or non-beneficial when they drop below a certain level. They do, however, and I'll stick to these words, become another type of workout. Simply, we're missing the objective of the workout. For whatever reason, you're not able to create power at the particular level that we're shooting for that day. So yeah, it does become something else. If that happens every once in a while, it's not a big deal. But if it happens consistently, then you're missing out on a training opportunity, a very particular one that we're trying to cultivate with a very particular type of workout comprised of very particular types of intervals. So you're just missing that point. It doesn't mean everything goes to hell in a handbasket and you're missing any sort of physiological benefit. It just means you're not sending as strong a message in the case of VO2 max intervals. And I'll just call this right from Dr. Coggins' list of expected physiological and performance adaptations, but there's a lot of things that happen, increases in plasma volume, mitochondrial enzymes, a lot of big fancy words, a lot of adaptation that happen really strongly when we work in that VO2 max range, when we're really challenging our heart and our lungs and the muscles, so our central system and our peripheral system to work through really high levels of power output. When you slip away from that, those stimuli aren't as strong. So you're not getting the same response you would. So, you know, maybe on days like that, especially if they happen routinely, you just realize like, I can't do this type of workout today. I'm going to do something else. Missing an interval here and there doesn't mean they become less effective. Well, they do become a little less effective, but it doesn't mean they become worthless and it's not a waste of your time. But if it happens consistently, you need to start looking at your recovery relative to your training. If you can't do workouts this hard ever, then something's up. Either the power level is simply too high for you as a percentage of your FTP, or you're simply not recovering well and you can't do the workout as intended. But they're not a waste of time.
Another thing Dr. Coggins says too is that, people kind of get confused on this, is that the zones and VO2 max, the threshold and anaerobic, it's like a continuum. And so, Chad, or Coach Chad says, you know, it's 110 to 120. It's like if you go to 109.5, like instantly you're out of VO2 max and you're suddenly in threshold. It's not like that. It diminishes as you get less. I think 110 is just the a cutoff point. Yep. That
I just had to choose something, and 110 works pretty well, and it works across the board. A lot of coaches, a lot of physiologists peg it at 110. Doesn't mean it happens right at 110. So that's just our cutoff. So if you're, you know, we say 110 is a limit, but you're doing it 108 or 109, you're still very close. You're still probably achieving everything that we're after, we're after with workouts, VO2 max workouts.
So let's get less granular with this. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Nate.
I said, but probably 120 would be a little bit better than 109.
Ideally, and the shorter the intervals are, you know, the higher the intensity we want them to be. The longer the recovery is between them, the higher the intensity we can maintain.
So looking at this from kind of a wider perspective, I want to answer the last question that he has, where he says, how to determine when I've dropped below that beneficial threshold when I'm training outside without power. So I work with a junior race team, and a lot of these kids, they don't have power meters. You know, it's kind of crazy to get your child that's 12 years old a power meter or less, you know, and they're just starting out mountain biking.
My kid's five. He has a power meter on his little bike.
He's got a power meter on his Strider already somehow.
Yeah. He will soon.
Yes. Yeah. So in that case, with a lot of these kids, and these aren't just the juniors I work with. I see this with a lot of people. When they do, and regrettably, even when they do have power meters, but I see a lot of people go out and they do VO2, and I'm doing air quotes, VO2 intervals, and they just go full as hard as they can. And then they end up just tapering off massively by the end of that interval. And they're usually anywhere from 2 to 5 minutes long, is what they're trying to go for those intervals. But, let's talk about how you roughly kind of pace something like that when we're talking about perception, if that's what you have to rely on instead of a power meter.
Yeah, I'll take my answer first. So what I would do is, we talked about before with the physics and stuff in cycling, is say the wind's constant or there's no wind on that day, find a hill with a constant grade and do repeats on that for amount of time and try to get watch the distance. If you suddenly cut off and you can't make it up in that amount of time to that, like as far as you would go up that hill, then you know you're starting to taper off. But again, I mean, you're going to have to, you shouldn't start out, Jonathan's exactly right. You shouldn't start out just hammering it as hard as you can. Hopefully with doing a lot of workouts inside, you can kind of get that feel and really pace your way up. But it's just hard without a power meter. I don't know. What do you think, Chad?
When I do these outside, I've coached riders who have had to do them without power, and I just basically tell them they're looking for something pretty simple and that they want to ramp their breathing up to its highest rate. They don't want to be panting, huffing and puffing. Well, certainly huffing and puffing, but not panting. They shouldn't be gasping for breath, but they should be taking the biggest, fullest breaths they can. Legs are starting to well up. It's a very particular form of fatigue, and it hurts real bad, but you can sustain it for literally minutes at a time, and not too many minutes, mind you, 1, 2, maybe 3 minutes at the high end of things. And it's just kind of a level of pain that you learn indoors and then just kind of try to carry that outdoors. It's a very particular place. You feel like, oh, I can't do this, but then the seconds keep ticking by and you haven't fallen off pace. Your breathing's ramped up, your muscles are welling up, but they're not pushing you to that point where you have to bail out. So you kind of have to determine, and in the case of deciding when to cut them off, the distance measure is excellent if you have a hill that you don't mind repeating. Mm-hmm. But you can also tell when it just falls apart, when everything starts to slow down, the lactate just, or the acidity skyrockets, your breathing exceeds that point where you can't really keep up with it anymore. There are telltale signs.
Yeah, and it's not just pain and discomfort, but you'll notice your performance as well will be dropping in addition to that. That's an important thing because, as Chad said, these are supposed to be uncomfortable. I think one of the best tips you can give yourself too, if you're going to be doing these VO2 intervals, is to start seated rather than standing up. And I know that sounds silly, but when you start standing up, you tend to just get pictures of Cavendish or Caleb Ewan in your head, and you think that you can just sprint like a beast and get into that VO2 zone as quick as you can and then settle in. And more often than not, we push it too hard, like what Nate was talking about there. So work your way into things. And it's just like Chad said, I like that difference. You will be breathing very hard, very hard, and it will be uncomfortable. But it shouldn't be to the point where you're completely out of breath or you're feeling like you're at the point of exploding. You want to stay just below that.
I feel
it's
like
gonna
that.
Hurt and be uncomfortable, but yeah, it's certainly not. I don't want to get in help. So it's not a sustainable thing for a long period of time. When you're doing it, you will know this is not sustainable for a long period of time.
And see, that's the nature of VO2 max work, is we're trying to spend as much time as we can within the confines of the workout, usually about an hour, right? At a very high percentage of VO2 max. And if you go out, you know, guns a-blazing, and 30 seconds later you fall off, well, at best, you got 30 seconds near VO2 max. But if you go out a little more conservatively, ramp up your breathing to a very high level, but then you can hang on for a minute and a half, maybe 2 minutes, that interval is going to be far more effective in terms of the adaptations we're looking for with intervals like this.
Yeah, I just did 3 minute intervals at VO2 max, and I don't want to give the wrong impression. I feel like we might be, but so the first minute, I'm like, okay, this is good. The second minute, I'm like, this is incredibly hard. The third minute, I'm like, Chad, what are you doing to me? Like, my power meter's miscalibrated. Everything's wrong. And then as soon as I finished that last third minute, you know, I think I had a good amount of rest between each interval. I was like, there's no way I can do any more. Yeah. But then after about a minute and a half or 2 minutes, I'm like, okay, I can get this next one. I'll try one
more.
Yeah,
That's perfectly stated, point. Nate. I almost always divide my VO2 max efforts into thirds, whether they're you know, 1 minute long and those are 20 second thirds, or 2 minutes, 3 minutes, whatever. The thirds work just like that. The first third is manageable. It's already uncomfortable, but it's manageable. The second third requires a lot of focus, and then that third effort or that third segment is basically just doing everything I can to get through it, all the while telling myself, this is it. This is the last interval I'm going to be able to do today. I'm done after this.
Yeah, that third section, what I always think back is on climbs where I've dropped people. I'm like, uh-huh. This is the pain that gives me the... And it's crazy in road racing. Like, just a 1 minute of working extra hard can totally make you, you know, podium yep. finish. Where if you don't have that minute, you'll be off the back and be the last place guy.
Yeah, those final minutes or the final third of each of those efforts are the game changers. That's what pushes you to new levels. That's what separates the wheat from the chaff. That's when people usually quit. But mm-hmm. you know, when you're locked into an interval workout, especially if you're on a smart trainer and you're truly locked into it, and you gut out that last little effort, it hurts, and it hurts real bad, but you get through the recovery and you find a way to do it again. And it's that distinction, that last third of those intervals, that will make you a faster rider.
Chad, mm-hmm. is it fair to say that those first two thirds of the VO2 max workout is kind of setting your body up for that last mm-hmm. third, and that's where the yeah. primary adaptions are happening?
Yeah, so that's what, you know, hopefully over the first third is what pushes you up to that really high level of your VO2 max. And then this is why, as the workouts progress, you either see longer intervals and or shorter recoveries, because we're trying to not lose that. And we ramp you up to a point, and then the recoveries bring you back down. Well, we don't want to bring you down too far, because then you got to ramp yourself back up to it, and you're missing some of the potential benefit from staying ramped up. So as much time as possible as you can spend at that high level of aerobic uptake is what we're after. And you know, we have to make that tolerable. We can't just throw you into 3 minute efforts with 30 second recoveries in between and yeah. say best of luck. We have to, or I have to, when I develop the training plans and the workouts, kind of ease you into that, so as to cultivate like a physiological and a psychological understanding of, you know, what these feel like, how much they hurt. But this brings up another point, in that in sets of them where we have, like, maybe you have short recoveries in between and then longer recoveries during the sets. If you've noticed, that first effort starting a new set is often the hardest. And you know, you could argue that the last one's harder. It probably is. But it's so hard to get back into it, because you have to ramp everything back up again. You have to get to that high level of aerobic uptake. And the first effort, you spend a lot of time ramping back into it. And then the rest of them come just a little more easily.
And that's kind of the ramping up. That's the science behind Tabatas, right? Where it's 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off, is to kind of yep. keep you at that yeah. high aerobic uptake.
Exactly. You never stray far from it. And that's why a lot of these, like, 30 second on, 30 second off, and I've got a whole new slew of workouts that will come out when the training camps are released, where you work for 30 seconds and only recover for 10. Same idea. We're not trying to totally totally destroy you. We're trying to keep you ramped up so that you eke a lot of benefit out of short, intense sets. And when you compare yeah. that to what you face out on the race course, you know, criterium riders, cross-country mountain bike riders, cyclocross riders, that's the very nature of what they're doing. It's hard effort and then hang in there, and then hard effort and then hang in there. real short recoveries, high level of uptake and performance the entire time.
Speaking of that, Jonathan, you raced, didn't you? Did you race?
I did.
Last weekend?
I did. Not as much as I had planned to. I went to Sea Otter. So, to the Sea Otter Classic. For those that don't know, it's a race slash expo slash celebration of all things bikes. And it's at Laguna Seca, which is one of the most famous racetracks here in the U.S. And it's in Monterey, California. So, they have at any given moment, so there's a giant expo going on the inside, and a bunch of brands are releasing products, and all the big brands are there. And it seems like they enjoy it more than Interbike, much more so than Interbike. And it's kind of like a concentrated version of Interbike. It's like all the brands you really love to go see at Interbike, they're at Sea Otter, and there's not a lot of extra fluff. It's just like the good stuff. And then you're in the middle of the raceway. There's either crit racing or circuit racing going on Laguna Seca's track at any point. There's a dual slalom course going on right around you, and you can see that up on the hill at all times. There's a pump track challenge going on. There's cyclocross racing going on. There's mountain bike or cross country mountain bike racing going on, downhill mountain bike racing, enduro mountain bike racing, and they even had an e-bike race, which was fun to heckle at. So they had all that stuff going on. Yeah, I raced, it's funny, I raced enduro, and this is my first time racing enduro. I probably should have done this a long time ago just because it fits really well with like my skill set with past and motorcycle racing and everything else. But the efforts in that enduro event were, you know, it was anywhere from 3 to 6 minute stages. And so 3 to 6 minutes, and they were very pedally as far as enduro courses go, not very technical. So I spent the majority of that time pedaling. So it was really fluctuating, you know, in between a sprint out of a corner and then just trying to stick right there in my VO2 range for a while and hold that. And it was completely exhausting. But it's interesting to look at the power data from that because it's for this type of racing and even cross-country mountain bike racing, crit racing, cyclocross, these type of efforts, when we're talking about that on-off stuff, this is where VO2 stuff really comes into play. So
would this be anaerobic though?
Yeah, that they start very anaerobic in nature, but the more closely you stack them together, the less recovery you get themselves. They have to become increasingly aerobic because the anaerobic stores just don't replenish that quickly. So the more of them you do, the less recovery you get. It becomes more and more aerobic.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. So, and stay tuned. We recorded a bunch of podcast content from there, so we're going to have a special Sea Otter episode. It's going to be cool. So, we had a good time down there. So, stay tuned for that. This is a really good question, Chris. I think this is a lot of people always think of intervals like lights, or they think of power zones like light switches. Once you exit one zone, that switch turns off, and then you open up a new switch. And like Nate said, it's a progressive. It's progressive, and if you have to think of it in a mechanical way, think of it more like valves that taper and open and close very slowly and gradually. It's not such an absolute thing. So, Ian says, I've heard you guys speak about how critical a warm up is prior to a race. I was wondering if you could offer some general warm up ground rules that people can then apply to their respective disciplines in terms of interval times and intensities. Should a warm-up for a mountain bike race differ than that of a road race or a criterium? Chad, kick this one off. I know that we have a number of things to say, but go ahead.
Yeah, so we spoke a little last week on how these can be a bit subjective in that I've been experimenting with longer, slower warm-ups regardless of the intensity of the event that's coming right after, and it's kind of worked for me. I'm not saying that works for everybody, and there is generally the more intense and shorter the workout, the longer the warm up, and vice versa, or event rather than a workout. And because of that, it's often a good idea to generally warm, and then depending on the nature of your event, to tailor your warm up to include some efforts like the ones you're about to face. So if I'm warming up for a criterium, I'll do, you know, maybe 10 to 15, even 20 minutes of general spinning. And then I'll do some hard short efforts, you know, to simulate accelerating out of corners, trying to break away, trying to catch something that is breaking away, that sort of thing. For steadier state affairs like time trials, I'll do a gradual but progressive warm up. So same 15 or 20 minutes if I've got the time of general, where I just kind of ease things up there. And then if I know I'm going to be spending most of my time between 95, 98% of threshold, then I'll do 2 or 3 minutes. But either way, I make it similar in nature to the event that follows.
I know that one of the ones that I do pretty regularly before criteriums, and this also, this is pretty similar for cross-country mountain bike races, and there are a few exceptions, and I'll share those in a bit, but one of our workouts called Laurel. That's L-A-U-R-E-L, and it's 30 minutes long, 30-minute warm-up. And I generally, we talked about this yesterday, but there's kind of an inverse relationship between race duration and warm-up duration. If it's a short and very intense race, I am going to actually have probably a longer warm-up. Then if it's a longer race, like a long road race, it's going to start out pretty easy. I'm not going to put in a really intense, hard warm-up that's going to last me a long time beforehand, because I'm going to have plenty of time to get into the flow of things. I'll still have a warm-up that I like to do because I want to make sure, kind of run a systems check, so to speak, and make sure that my expectations are on point, but that's pretty much it. So Laurel, the way that it starts out is it starts you out just at 50% FTP and you're cruising along. And it's not very, I'll look up the actual distance since that's what you, or the duration since that's what you asked for. It has you spin in there and then you work your way up to about what, 75%, 70% FTP maybe. And that's going to be 10 minutes long, just a little over 10. And then after that, it has some blocks, a 2-minute interval that brings you a little closer to your threshold. I think maybe up to around 80%. And then you have like a 90%. Threshold, and you hold that for about, geez, what it looks like, 20. So for 5 minutes, it sits you right there just below your threshold. Then the one key thing that I find is don't rush the rests in between your intervals. This gives you 5 minutes to recover right after that. And then it pushes you, because once again, you're just trying to warm up. You're not trying to expand, you know, increase capacity or anything else on these warm-ups. And then after that, it puts you pretty high up there, up to around 150% or 140% looks like FTP for some short efforts. So they aren't going to last any more than a minute. And those efforts, those kind of clearing efforts are good. Now that's where I tend to customize things. For example, if I'm at a race and it's got a lot of short, 1 minute climbs or less, I'm probably gonna make those around a minute. But if I am at one that's going to be longer efforts, you know, 3 minute long climbs, 4 minute long climbs, whatever it may be, I might do something that's a little longer. Just the same, if the event has a 35 minute climb, I'm not going to do a 35 minute long, you know, interval there during the warm up. It's all within reason, but I'll toy with that a bit and change it around. Really, the one thing I've found is that you have to play around with warm ups to find out what works best. You can alter our workouts with the workout creator. That's a great way to do it. But you'll kind of find a routine that works best for you, and then you can customize it a little bit there. Nate, I know you've mostly done triathlon, but you've done a good chunk of road racing too, but do you have any warm-ups?
No, I suck at this. this is
And you've got a you know, you've got your first cross-country mountain bike race.
Yeah, I was
going
to say, I'm going to take over the podcast right now and answer it in my own question. So I have my first mountain bike race tomorrow morning. And on my fat bike, which now I'm kind of like, I rode everyone I've been complaining about in the office. I rode with somebody who I have a much higher watt per kilogram. We're about the same weight, but I'm probably 50 watts higher than him right now, maybe even 60 or 70. But he's got a little skinny hardtail, and I've got the big fatty that's probably, I don't know, 12, 13 pounds heavier than his bike. But on all the climbs, even in the flats, he was destroying me. And I think it's roller resistance. So, side note, I'm going to get a new mountain bike for racing, yeah, but fat bike's still really fun.
And really quick with that, something really interesting. So how much do you weigh right now, Nate?
190 this morning.
And then your FTP is roughly?
295.
And then I'm weighing like 148 right now, and my FTP is probably somewhere around like 280, 275. Nate and I went riding, same ride. We were both using power meters. And Nate, your normalized power, do you know what it was from that ride?
No, but I remember we were like just doing these little small climbs, and I was 100 watts higher than you for everything. Like we were like halfway through for normalized power, I was 100 watts higher than him.
Yeah, I think that I was at a normalized power at the end of the ride at like 140 or something, and a good amount of descending.
I was 240 at least, yeah.
Yeah, and he was even higher. So that's an interesting thing right there. Like, granted, I think that the fat bike was really good for you because it got you comfortable enough with mountain biking so that, number one, you could see it's fun. Number two, you could start focusing on building skills. But, man, it requires a lot from a person to be able to push that thing up a hill. Not just the weight, but the rolling resistance and everything else, the huge tread, the big wheels, So just, sorry, interesting anecdote.
I'm thinking it's rolling resistance. Okay, so for this race, I'm going to be doing two laps. I'm in Cat 3 first ride. I was going to warm up just by doing a lap because personally, seeing the course is going to, no matter how much time I have, but I feel like I need to ride the course once because that'll make me be able to go so much faster on it than while I race.
I would definitely suggest that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then do you think I should just try to ride it easy and then kind of power up some of the shorter climbs after I'm kind of warmed up? The kind of address what Jonathan said on the course.
One thing we haven't talked about is the psychological component of warming up, and that plays a much bigger role when your effort's going to involve high bits of intensity. So, you know, warming up for a steady state time trial or for a triathlon, although that the bike comes in after the swim, so you'll be warm from the swim by itself. But either way, warming up for a steady state event versus one that's far, far more explosive, you kind of got to get in the right mindset. And not everybody, I'm sure there are people who fly outside of this recommendation, but you have to effectively get your game face on. If you know it's going to hurt and probably going to hurt from the gun, you should probably have a couple efforts that hurt during your warm up so that you get in that mind space so that you know that these are the sort of efforts I'm going to have to dole out in just a few minutes here. Kind of wake yourself up to that those ideas.
So my next question is, my category. I think there's only one other guy in it, but podium. I'm going to be. If you're not first, you're last, right? Like Ricky Bobby. So there's going to be a whole bunch of other Cat 3s though, starting at the same time in other age groups. And how important is the start in mountain biking? Like, should I be like trying to sprint?
Yeah, I can't think of a mountain bike race I've ever done where the initial, 1, 2, 3 minutes, my tongue was out the entire time.
Why is it so important?
So go ahead, Chad.
Oh, go ahead. Well, I just say sometimes it's for positioning. Other times it's just because everyone else is so wound up. I'm not entirely sure. Criteriums are the same way, and that's not necessarily, well, that is actually about positioning too. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, so I think that the main thing is you've got single track, right? And everyone gets into situations where there are kind of two or three sides to the coin. Number one, if you're a good climber, or for a cross-country racing, you need to be a good climber, you need to be a good descender, and then number three, you need to be the type of person that can carry speed across flat or rolling sections. That isn't that different, I guess, than road racing, but in mountain biking, it's even more important because the descending is more technical, the climbing tends to be more steep and technical, and then carrying your speed through those flat sections requires technique, not just sustainable power, because you have to be able to put out power through that stuff. So when you look at that, if you have a limiter in one place or multiple of those spots, then when you get onto the course and you're stuck behind people and their limiters are hindering your race pace, then that sucks because you can't pass them in a lot of situations. You're just stuck behind them. You can ask to move by them, but if they're in the same category, they are in no way required to let you by. If they're in a different category, hopefully they do. But if you're noticeably faster than them, you can try to bushwhack with your fat bike. You could probably run over anything.
Yeah, no problem. You've seen me do that.
Yeah, but that's true, yeah. But that's kind of that's the reason you really want to get good positioning. And while drafting doesn't have an effect on the type of course that you'll be racing, Nate, some courses it does. The majority of cross-country mountain biking, it really doesn't. You're stuck in the trees. You're going pretty slow type of a thing. Because of that, there's no real, I guess there isn't a whole lot of benefit with drafting, but line choice is key. If there's a guy ahead of you with great line choice, that can be very good to follow him. Maybe he knows the course better than you. Maybe he's just a better descender and you can stick with him.
That happened 2 days ago to me.
Yes. Yeah, Nate leveled up, right?
Yeah, I went with, I did a course with Jonathan, and I could actually, the ground was a little bit wet and I could see where his lines were, and I followed his lines, and I think I went twice as fast on the descents until I crashed.
Way more. Yeah. Yeah, it was awesome. Nate was charging.
It was really fun until I crashed.
There's this, and I'm sure you guys listening to this, it's like when you're on a climb and you see guys on a climb, and even we see this on TV. They're going slower than 13 miles an hour. They're not enjoying a lot of the benefits that you get from a draft, if any at all. But they're on that climb, and they're just trying. They're trying as hard as they can to stick together. There's a mental aspect to that when you're sticking with somebody. Totally. And you can hold with them. You know, I don't know if you can back me up on that, Chad and Nate, but
oh yeah, it's, and you see in the tour all the time, it's like, it's frustrating because they'll do that and then the quote unquote rubber band snaps and as they just get like two or three spots and then they're suddenly like a half K back, right? Because they just gave up mentally.
Exactly.
And yeah. So
that's,
I'd like to think that I could beat that.
Yeah, that's the thing with cross-country racing is that, number one, positioning. Everyone's fighting for that. And then number two, you're really trying to get with guys that are as fast or faster than you ideally, because you, it's so hard. There's constant steep pitches, and they're not just steep and you can hammer up them as hard as you want. You're fighting for traction, so it requires a bunch of strength with your body. It's really demanding. So having that carrot to hold on to is really, really beneficial. Positioning is the main thing, but that carrot's key.
How does lining up work?
So you want to examine the first turn big time. You want to look, or if there's no first turn right off the bat, if it just funnels into the single track, you want to look at where it funnels in and look at ideal lines. Watch for rain ruts, watch for rocks, watch for soft sandy sections that might suck up your momentum, anything like that. What you want to find is, from the start, you want to draw the best line straight to the first turn or through that first section. And that's where you'd want to line up. Always, if you can, do everything you can to line up in the front row. In some cases, they'll have call-ups and you won't get brought up to the front row. And if that's the case, try to look at guys in front of you that you think are going to be slow. Maybe they look like a Fred and they won't be able to clip into their pedals, you think? So you can,
I look
kinda...
like a Fred.
So you can look at those guys and try to not line up behind them. Nate will just show up and nobody will be behind him.
And, yeah, exactly. Stay away from that guy. I'll be like, hey, I'm a triathlete.
Right. Yeah, good idea. You'll have the whole row to yourself.
I should go sleeveless jersey. No socks.
That'd be awesome.
Backpack, fat bike.
That's the main thing with the start, is always get as far up as you can and pick a good line through the first turn. In many cases, that good line is going to be the inside. Because you can hold a shorter line, but in some cases, if you can go outside and avoid a mess, that's not all bad too. So definitely pre-ride the course. I think I'm looking at a previous race that happened on the same course that you're going to race, Nate. I think I am, right now. I'm looking at it on Strava and it looks like you've got some doozies of climbs. So it looks like you're going to have climbs that are around 11. So you're going to be looking at like 6 minute climb, each lap, you're going to have like a 4 minute climb, a 6 minute climb, and then just some rolly stuff that's constantly going up, but with some steep chunks. And that's going to take about another 6 minutes. So,
but then, Jonathan, I think we're missing the sad fact of the matter is that only a handful of people can line up front and can choose the line they're going to follow into that first corner. So, another thing you have to keep in mind is you have to learn to survive the melee and be patient. So it's going to start out hectic. People are not going to be getting clipped in. There might be minor crashes or skirmishes, all sorts of stuff that you can't let deflate your enthusiasm or your motivation. So just know that no matter how badly you start, there's a whole race ahead of you. So if that first turn doesn't go well, if you don't get positioned for the single track or going into in a criterium, if you're 40 riders back, persevere, hang in there. It's there's still a long race ahead.
That's what I think about in my running career, is there's so many, every single race that's like, everyone starts off so fast and I just like, cool, run in front of me, run in front of me, run in front of me. Mm-hmm. And then after a mile,
see you soon.
Yep. It's like so much better physiologically to just pace it evenly. But Jonathan, you have a great point, is I might not be able to pass these guys. So maybe if those climbs are like fire roads, I could totally, it might be okay then. Because I'm not going to pass anyone on the downhill.
Yeah, and in pretty much every cross-country course, they will intentionally put in sections of wider road so that you can make passes, and they'll occasionally pop up throughout the lap so that you can make those passes. The one thing to keep in mind is that the guys that you're racing with, whereas if it's a marathon or something else, a lot of those guys, they're training for the distance, and mountain bikers specifically train for a balls-out start where their eyes are popping out of their head, and then still managing to hold a high intensity, you know, off and on the whole race. So as a result, what you can do is, it certainly is, mountain biking in a lot of ways is a race of attrition, because it's such a demanding profile and people can crash and lose time and everything else. So you can definitely play the long ball, and you probably should, especially since it's your first race. But having said that,
that's what I was thinking.
The start is still key, and Geez, you're a triathlete. You know this better than almost anybody. You get kicked in the face, punched, everything else when you're in the swim. It's rough. And in mountain biking, when you start out, keep your elbows out. And don't worry when guys hit you and bump you. But the reason you keep your elbows out, not only is it a better, more aggressive position that gives you more control on the bike, but the reason you have your elbows out is because then you're going to hit elbows with a person before you lock bars, right? Just keep your elbows out and you bump your way through the first bit, and then things settle down usually pretty quickly. So once you get into the steep, nasty single track.
I've been kicked in the face many times. You can imagine sprinting while you're swimming, getting kicked in the jaw. And like it, some people, like it hurts really bad too, or people pulling on you. But I feel like too in cycling, being 6'6", 190 on a fat bike, I'm like one of the bigger guys there.
Maybe like not the Flying Dutchman. Like,
yeah. Cool. Well, last question. I think this race is going to be like probably 48 minutes for the Cat 3s or somewhere around there. I have a backpack that I'm going to wear. It's a POC one just for spinal protection because I don't want to crash and break my back, and that's fine. But do you think I should carry water or just no water at all?
Looking, a little bit of water. What's the weather like that day? I guess that's the big question. So I always
it's going to be muddy too. I think it's going to be muddy because it's going to rain today and tomorrow, which is really good for my.
Oh, there's your water.
Hopefully,
yeah. Just open your mouth.
But I mean, just in general, at a short race like that, do you guys, like, let's say it's a crit that's that long, do you guys put a water bottle on, especially if there's a lot of climbing?
Yeah,
or not?
Jonathan's point's a good one. If it's a super hot day, absolutely. I'll try to pack it with ice, although the ice lasts for all of 5 minutes once the once you sit out in the heat. But typically, when races are really quickly paced and they're short like that, and they're going to be really fast paced when they're short like that, I don't have time to get my hands off the bars. So even if I have a bottle, I just end up carrying it around the race anyways. There are instances, more comfortable riders or less technical courses, where you actually can grab your bottle and grab a quick drink. And that's all good and fine. But I find with races under an hour, I don't even bother with a bottle anymore.
That's what I was worried about, is that it'll be so technical. And I don't want to like take my hand off a little while and kind of let up and take a drink.
Yeah. And this should be a pretty technical course too.
Great.
It's on the same property as where a race called the TDS, and I'll abbreviate it because I don't want to say the actual, it's quite a vulgar name, but the TDS Enduro. And it's known for being a really rough enduro, and don't worry, the trails that you'll be racing on, Nate, are not the same trails that they were going down, the crazy rock gardens and everything else. But it's a pretty technical course in a lot of spots, then really smooth in other spots. So you may very well have time to drink. I would put some water in there, if at the very least, just to keep your mouth from getting too dry. You'll be breathing, you'll be tongue in the spokes type of a thing probably for a lot of this. So, and to be honest, that's really what, if it's a cool day, that's what I have that bottle for on a short race. That type of duration is usually where like my short track races would be. They'll be a little shorter than that. My XC races tend to be 90 minutes or above. I think it's always worth it to carry water with you just in case.
And I won't do the, maybe not fill up all 70 ounces of my Camelback. But the other thing is too, is during this race, so we've talked a lot about sugar adaption. During the race, I think I am going to put Gatorade in it, just because there's been a lot of research saying that sweetness during your ride can up your performance.
Yeah.
So although I'm training with water, race with Gatorade.
Psychological benefit, but it's a benefit. So why not?
Yeah, it gives me cotton mouth.
You just
like
ruined
crazy.
It. You took it away from me, Chad.
just believe.
Okay, I believe.
It gives me cotton mouth like crazy if I drink Gatorade like that. But
yeah, same, I love it.
Teach
it's
his
like
own,
a treat.
So. I'm unless it's ice cold, which is pretty much an impossibility, unless it's actually cold out, in which case I don't want ice cold. So yeah. I don't bother.
Another pro tip: whenever I do triathlons, is I bring a cooler. And a pretty good cooler that I leave in my truck. And in there, I put in, all my like, if I'm driving to it, my drinks, what I'm going to drink for during my ride, and then post-race drinks. And just being able to go back there and take out an ice cold whatever, if it's a recovery shake or anything, just having that ice cold thing that you really want. And right before the race, too, taking a bottle out and it's like dripping wet and partially frozen. That is so nice. And it's just like, it's probably part mental too, but it just feels really good. After the race too, Especially when I watch Tour de France, because they all drink Coke. I never drink straight, like real Coke. Oh, you know what? I should. I'm going to Costco. I should buy the Mexican Coke with the real sugar.
Yeah.
Just get a Coke out of a glass bottle right after a race.
Good.
Oh man,
that feels good.
That's a treat.
That sounds almost as good as a beer.
Yeah.
So
Three
quick XC tips, and then we'll close off. And XC being cross country. Number one, Nate, when you're starting out, go as hard. Find every single opportunity you can to get around people in the start. It generally what happens is everyone goes like crazy. They hit the first turn and then their tongue's already in the spokes. And then after that, they just kind of are pedaling along and trying to survive. And don't get content there. Just keep trying to grab and just think one position at a time, snag little positions, head off the trail if you need to in a quick little spot just to get another spot. So always be searching for positions. Number two, in the beginning, don't be looking at the person in front of you like you are in a road race when you're looking at their shoulders or anything else like that. Be offline from them, unless it's like a really fast, you know, start and you need to draft, but be offline from them and be looking ahead for spots where you can make that move. That's a huge thing, because if you're following them on a mountain bike, everyone's changing lines so quickly, you end up always hitting your brakes and it gets tricky. And then number three, find whatever your advantage is, and your advantage if with a fat, number one, you've got good fitness,
none.
But number two, you've got really good traction, right? So if there's a spot where it's slippery or anything else like that, fully exploit that and look at that every lap and look forward to that point when you're really going to put time on people.
Yeah. I'll stare at them while I pass them.
Yeah, there we go. There we are. Stink eye them. That'll work.
Fat is fast.
Yes. Those are three things. So
that's good stuff.
Help. Yep. All right. Let's go. Let's move on to Steve's questions. The next one. He says, hi, guys. Love the podcast. Surely the best cycle training resource on the internet. Nice. That's good. My question is around the sprint triathlon plan, specifically the low volume. Experience tells me I can't train 6 days a week as the recovery just isn't sufficient for me. If I were to follow the sprint plan but run it over 8 days rather than seven, would that give me the same level of performance, albeit over a longer period of time? Or is the frequency of each discipline now too low to achieve those gains?
Steve, so let's break down some coaching paradigms here. You know, typically, we operate on mesocycles, macrocycles, and microcycles. Mesos being your years, but we at Trainer Road are starting to see those more in terms of seasons. Macrocycles are your training phases. We stick pretty rigidly to that. But then microcycles are commonly 7 days. And, you know, it's pretty obvious why that is, because it's too hard to change your week every week, you know, especially for a multi-sport athlete. You swim on certain days, you run on certain days. You know, you have other obligations in life that see to it. The weekends are probably the best times for your long rides, et cetera. If, however, you have the flexibility to operate outside of those confines, there's no reason why you shouldn't at least give it a shot. You may find that extra day of recovery goes miles towards making you a faster athlete, keep making you, helping you reap greater benefit out of the harder stuff, helping you enjoy the less difficult stuff, giving you just that little bit more time to spend with your family or work on your job, whatever. But there's no reason you have to stick to that 7 day paradigm if you have the flexibility to operate outside of it. So give it a shot. I think it's honestly, I've gravitated of late more toward a cycle where I train hard for a day, ride easy, and then a little bit moderate that third day. So I'm like on a 3 day cycle and I just keep turning that over, but I have the flexibility to do that. Once I start butting up against races, I'll have to get a little more, I'll have to think a little farther ahead, and that cycle might not work as well, but you can still be flexible. So if you can find a different way to structure your week, one that works better for you, by all means, do it.
This kind of brings up what a new feature we're going to launch soon, which is the ability to choose a training plan and execute against it. And normally what people do, and we will have this sometime in the future, but they have a calendar and you put the workouts on each day of the calendar. And then when you miss that workout, you kind of like, you feel horrible and that kind of thing. This new way, what we're going to do is you choose a training plan, and I like to think of it as like a bingo card where you check the workouts off, and you can, sometimes you skip them, sometimes you do them outside, but that makes it for when you do have to add an extra day of rest or you push things back, it makes it very easy to just say, okay, I had that extra day of rest, but my next workout's still the same and I can check it off, and you can be a little more flexible that way, and you can kind of, sometimes too, depending on racing and what I have in life, I'll switch workouts around. maybe my Thursday workout is now my Wednesday workout or something like that.
Yeah, and that's a good point too. So even within a 7-day cycle, even if you're going to rigidly stick to that 7-day cycle week after week after week, and so many athletes do, there's nothing to say you can't move your workouts around within that week. You know, sometimes you may find it works really well. Sometimes it may be difficult. Maybe you have to stack a couple hard workouts a little too close together. But the fact is you have that flexibility. You don't have to rigidly adhere to the structure we set forth if it's not what works for you every time.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think we never so the whole concept of templated plans, we don't prescribe to that at all, or we don't subscribe to that at all. We really truly believe that the best way to get the best training is to have customized training, and this is all part of it. And to be honest, customizing it to your FTP, changing that around, making sure that it's specific for the type of event you're doing, that it's periodized properly. These are all the things that go into making a proper training plan. So our goal is just to make that as optimized as possible for guys in your position, Steve. So then, and for all of us, really, you know.
Yeah, so they are a little bit templated, but it's normally you go to some place and it's like there's one plan, and this is like the cycling plan, and we have 88 plans. And then you put those together.
Let's not fool ourselves. I mean, it's not like anybody that's making a training plan is reinventing the wheel when they make that. I mean, it sounds stuff that we understand. It's all based on principles and paradigms, coaching paradigms, like Chad has mentioned. It's all based on that. And, you know, that's what people pull from.
The fact of the matter is most athletes lack structure such that if we give them, you know, any of these plans and they follow it to the letter, they'll probably get faster. It may not be optimal, but they will get faster. So, you know, the more you train, the more you train with structure and periodization and progression and all these buzzy coaching words, the more you do this, the more you learn about yourself as a rider, and the more you can start to customize these plans and tweak them so that they do become closer to optimal.
And the more you listen to the podcast. That's what I kind of feel like.
True story.
That is probably 90-95% of it. Then you can eke out an extra 5%, depending on your age and experience, by then doing small tweaks yourself by the knowledge that you learn from the internet and all that kind of stuff, and then experience with your own body, finding out what works.
And that's really
the main thing
best
is just consistency and structure.
Yeah, and that's the Agreed. Best way for us to make people faster is to educate people, like, and to help them understand what's going on, so then you can make the right decisions when you change it. It's like we're tooting our own horn here, but I'm passionate about
it. Yeah, just turned into
that.
A sales podcast.
Yeah, I know, right? I'm sorry, guys. I'm just really passionate about that. I like that we aren't just, you know, throwing garbage out here and letting you take care of it. We really do want to change things. So anyways, last question. Let's move on to Andrew. He says, great podcast. I heard Jonathan, I think, mentioned a little about how he was adjusting his workouts for a knee injury. Any recommendations on workouts or plans on Trainer Road when dealing with another typical bike injury, lower back and hip pain? He says, I've stayed off the bike and stuck to a regimen of core work, strength, agilities, and running for now, but I'm looking for any way I can build up the right foundation and correct form when I get back on the bike. Chad, I think that you're probably better suited to answer this. I maybe can add some anecdotes.
Yeah, all I can say is this is outside of our scope, Andrew. You're going to have to work with a physical therapist, sports therapist, someone who can direct you better than we can. I will say when you do start to phase your bike workouts back into it, it's going to be a process, and anything that aggravates your injury is something to be avoided. So I can only be pretty general on this, but I'm dealing with a back injury right now, and it's the same thing. I'm deferring to an expert, and then what that expert tells me, I'm going to try to apply that to my training. I can get away with certain things, so I still have those in the mix, but anything that hurts me right now, I absolutely avoid.
And I can just anecdotally back up the general advice there, in the sense that the way I've been working in bike rides, it's been it's just a simple overuse injury that's caused by a muscle imbalance in my glutes, and then that's caused a whole issue with my hip and down to my knee, and it's mostly manifest in my knee. But the way that I've been working back in is putting out a huge amount of power, that doesn't necessarily hurt it, but it's the time and it's the amount of revolutions that I end up putting on that overuse injury that really tend to inflame it. So I have to keep things short, and when I'm riding, and I've been doing a lot of outdoor riding, mountain biking, because one thing I can do is work on my bike skill and my handling. If I'm not going to be working on specifically on raising my FTP, then I'm going to be focusing on that. And I really try to always be, if I'm not looking ahead at a rock or something else like that, I'm always looking at my knees to make sure they're tracking well, because that's one thing that I can do to make sure and focus on engaging the right muscles when I'm pedaling. Because like Chad said, it's a process. So if you are going to be spending time on the trainer, make sure that, like Chad said, it's not aggravating you. But then number two, make sure that you're focusing on technique as a first focus when you're on the bike.
Yeah, one thing Andrew says that you're using running. Oh my goodness, running for recovery for a knee problem does not sound like that would help. That sounds like it would hurt.
If your doctor said so, I guess, I don't know.
Yeah.
Seems crazy.
So here's something that works for me, and this seems counterintuitive, and please don't do it because I don't want to give medical, I don't know. We're in the US, like I'm scared to give any medical advice. But so I've had back pain only a few times in my life where kind of like my lower back, if I like just bend over it a certain way, it'll kind of get a shooting pain and I'll kind of lock up for a second. Every time I've had that, the way that I fix it is, it sounds weird, but I start doing deadlifts until I can get to do, when I can do heavy deadlifts, it goes away. And I know like with my parents.
You sound crazy.
You know, they're 70. They go like, they're like, oh, you have back pain? Don't do anything with your back. Like, don't touch anything. And then I'm the opposite. I'm like, okay, I'm going to start with light deadlifts and work all the way up. And the deadlifts don't hurt while I'm doing it. And really, when I get up to, I can like rep 300 pounds a few times, boom, no more back pain. And I'm fine. And any joint injuries, it's always been different. Usually with joint, with overuse, it kind of has to heal. And I look at like, there's something else that's causing the joint problem, whether it's my fit or my running stride. With IT band stuff, it's always been my glute medius. And if I work that up, I've been good. Another one was, I'd sit like I'm on a chair, but I'd be leaning against the wall and I would put a little ball between my legs and I would work the inner part of the quad. And that would also, that's helped with my knee tracking before, is I'd have a weak, Chad, what's the name of that quad? It's the teardrop run. I forget the name of it, but it's the internal one, the one that gets huge on cyclists.
Vastus medialis.
Yeah. So that would, I put a ball between you, and kind of squeeze it. So if you kind of sit like you're on a chair leaning against the wall, put a ball between your legs and squeeze it just a little bit, you can really focus on that muscle. And that's helped with my, where I've had knee tracking problems.
Is that like a tiny ball, Nate, or is that a big one?
Yeah, like a small, kind of like a really large softball size. Like a little, my physical therapist gave it to me to.
But see what Nate's talking about here is not just the healing process, but also or subsequently addressing the deficiency. So he's talking about two different approaches, and yeah, you have to heal, but you also have to ask yourself, why did this injury happen in the first place? And Nate's jumping ahead to that, and he's found what helps him avoid those back injuries. So for whatever reason, his back strength becomes deficient over a period of time, starts to get these flare ups, and then he starts to address it, and that deficiency goes away. That's where the physical therapist or the sports therapist comes into play. They're the ones
totally.
Who tell you need to be healing right now, and then you need to address the issue. Or perhaps you can do both at once, but you know they're going to steer you in a very, very direct or correct course of treatment.
What I don't like is where people like they heal it and then they're like,
I'm
not going to do anything. Yeah, leave it alone. Like don't ever. I think it's a generational thing. With my parents, like I have a knee problem. Or so I'm just going to stop walking. I can't walk anywhere. And rather than kind of see why they have that problem, it just makes their health worse over time. And then they get another problem.
So
they're like, oh, I can't do this. I got to sit down all day.
So you
sorry,
heal.
Sorry, parents.
Then you heal. Then you address the deficiency. And then you have to maintain how you've addressed it. So it's not something that you just fix once and just hope that everything's going to be good. You have to stay on top of it. There is some maintenance that's in order.
Yeah, great points.
All right, I guess that covers it then for this episode. Remember, you can submit your questions to trainerroad.com/podcast. You can find the form on there to enter your questions in. Ask whatever questions you can. We go through as many as we can each week, and we do look at all of them. We just can only answer so many. We only have so much time. So we appreciate all the questions. Keep them coming in. And remember, you can find and share this podcast. I encourage the share part with all your cycling friends and others. You can do so through iTunes, through SoundCloud, through any podcasting app you use. And you can leave comments on there on SoundCloud and ask more questions on there or on Twitter. You can use Ask Trainer Road, that hashtag. and we'll pick it up on there as well. Thanks again, guys. Happy training.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.